traffic and jobs beat basketball. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. And from the crowd yesterday, you'd think it was fourth quarter, down by two, 3 seconds on the clock. But actually, it was a Seattle City Council land use vote. And that vote might have changed Seattle's odds of building a third sports venue in SoTo and maybe getting an NBA team. This whole thing involved developer Chris Hansen, who already has a deal to build a basketball arena on First Avenue South, but doesn't yet have an NBA team to play there. Seattle Times reporter Jeff Baker came by this morning to tell us about it. I asked him to remind us what Chris Hansen wanted from the city in the first place.
What he wanted was to get access to part of Occidental Avenue South, and the reason is because the street was going to run right through center court of his new arena, or center ice, depending on which sport you like. But you can't build an arena when you have a street going through it, and so he needed the city to give up that street, and he was going to pay $18 to $20 million, plus build a pedestrian bridge, some sidewalk space, do some public benefits in order to gain access to that street. After that, he would have had 5 years to actually build on that street, but in order to get public financing for it, he would have needed to get an NBA team before November of 2017, which is when his funding deal runs out with the city and county.
Well, yesterday the city council heard all kinds of reasons not to build this arena. We heard about jobs. We heard about traffic. We also heard about how much people really love and miss the Supersonics. So how is it that jobs and traffic won over the Sonics here?
Well, that's a very good question. And I guess part of the issue which happens with any sports debate in any city in America, it's not just a Seattle thing, is that sometimes the sports angle tends to get misrepresented by the degree of passion that is shown by fans. And what I'm saying is, you know, you can listen, you can go on a sports talk radio at any time of the day, and it seems like there's millions and millions of fans that are clamoring for something to happen. And what you don't hear from are the people out there who are housing advocates, who are advocates for, you know, decent wage jobs. You don't hear that as passionately as you do with sports. In the end, I think what you got to do is listen to what they said during their speeches. They made a lot of impassioned speeches about jobs, about the Port of Seattle. And I think, you know, whoever was lobbying from the Port of Seattle side got through to those council members.
I'm talking with Jeff Baker. He's an enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times. We're talking about the vote that happened last night at the Seattle City Council. The council voted 5-4 against allowing developer Chris Hansen to vacate a street in the SoTo neighborhood to build a new arena. The arena was supposed to be for an NBA team, potentially for a National Hockey League team as well. We don't have either of those in Seattle right now, by the way. We have neither an NBA nor an NHL team, but this was an arena for them to come. And after the vote yesterday, Mayor Murray said that this makes it less likely that the National Basketball Association will ever return to Seattle. Do you think he's right?
I don't think he's right about them ever returning to Seattle. I had my doubts that they were going to be able to return here the way the current memorandum of understanding is constructed between Hansen, the city, and the county, because it requires him to get an NBA team, you know, as of November 2017, or else he can't get funding. And, you know, when I was in New York 2 weeks ago, I asked NBA Commissioner Adam Silver about that, and he gave me absolutely no indication that the league was prepared to expand here that quickly. He said expansion is not anybody's priority within the league right now. They're trying to negotiate a new collective bargaining agreement between players and owners. They have $24 billion in new TV revenue that's coming in nationally, and they have to figure out how to split it up. The players want a bigger share, of course, and the owners want to keep as much as they can. So adding one or two new teams to the mix and splitting it up even more isn't really on the agenda right now.
What is Chris Hansen saying about this vote?
Chris Hansen put out a statement last night on his website, sonicsarena.com, and he basically said they haven't given up the fight. They're going to keep going. But as of this point, nobody really knows how he's going to be able to keep going. He could theoretically go back to council and ask to have another vote. But it's going to be politically difficult for some of these council members now after a lot of them put their necks out. Some of them are taking a lot of heat this morning for their vote from fans. It's going to be tough for them to come back and then flip-flop and go the other way on an issue without having some splaining to do. I don't know. The other alternative for Hansen could be maybe, you know, against all odds, the NBA is going to come out and award him a team at some point prior to November of 2017 because his MOU is still in effect. I mean, if they were to do that, he could then go back to council with a very persuasive argument that, hey, if you give me this now, I've got a team here. We're not just building this thing for nothing. And that could potentially sway votes. Other than that, I'm at a loss to explain how he's going to get it done.
I want to ask you about the Mariners now. They have a new CEO, John Stanton, and last week one of the first public quotes he gave was to say that this arena that Chris Hansen wanted to build in Soto would be like a big, ugly house right at the end of your driveway, meaning right in front of Safeco Field. You're saying it's going to be hard for Chris Hansen to build this arena in Soto. Is that dream of building a new arena for an NBA team, is it over?
It's over, I think, in that Soto location, definitely. I mean, right now, when I spoke to Sally Bagshaw right after the vote, I spoke to her for about half a minute. And the first thing she said to me is, you know, I said, where do we go from here? And she said, we have to take a look at Key Arena, because there's been a report by the AECOM architectural firm. It's a global firm that said you could renovate it for $285 million and make it NBA NHL compliant. Now, is that true? I don't know, because they have to do a more exhaustive financial study on it. And that's exactly what Sally Bagshaw suggested we get to doing. I've seen records recently, public records that suggest she's already been talking to local merchants associations about perhaps looking at privatizing some of the land in Seattle Center to see if they could build some adjacent businesses around the arena to make it more profitable and make it easier to lure an owner to come in and perhaps spend private money. I mean, that's the whole objective. The city's not going to spend $285 million on Key Arena. They need an owner to come in, a team owner, and spend that money. But you have to make it financially attractive to them. Everybody knows arenas aren't a very profitable venture for anybody. You need the surrounding businesses to make it work.
Seattle Times reporter Jeff Baker. Last March, just before Bernie Sanders took the stage at a packed Key Arena, the crowd heard a new voice in Washington state politics.
I am honored to introduce the next president of the United States, Senator Bernie Sanders!
That's Charles Adkins, a Native American high school student who used to be homeless. He told his story to David Hyde.
On March 20th of this year, at the Bernie Sanders rally in Seattle, the campaign brought on a special speaker to rile up the crowd.
He has shown that he is a true man of the people. And the reason why I am on this stage is because Bernie gives us a future to believe in.
18-year-old Charles Adkins. In some ways, he's like other ambitious people his age. He's set on a clear career path. In his case, politics. He's already the vice president of the Washington State High School Democrats. But Adkins definitely isn't one of those Bernie bros you've heard so much about. He used to be homeless. And he's a member of the Yurok tribe of Northern California.
From the terrible exploitation of our land by corporations to the ridiculous and useless drug war that this country is waging, we are often an afterthought, and that needs to change.
And Adkins was raised in a military family, a family where there was the experience of war and lots of moves on and off the reservation and all over the country. That took a toll on them, including his father, who served the military for a second time after 9/11 in Iraq and Afghanistan. And after he returned home, things were different. Adkins told me that the two of them ended up butting heads a lot.
Over simple stuff like homework and when to do chores and whatnot. But then other things I remember one instance where my mother and father were having an argument, and they were both drinking and whatnot, and eventually I decided that I would take me and my brothers and out of the house, and we'd go over to a neighbor's.
Why?
And because they were just kept on arguing, and I didn't want my brothers to see my parents arguing, their parents arguing.
And the conflict at home escalated.
Eventually, I got into a big fight with my father, and he got arrested, and eventually I didn't want to live there anymore.
So at age 15, Adkins was out on the streets, homeless. He lived that way for about 6 months and later ended up for a couple of years in a shelter in Everett. That experience changed him.
Being homeless made me realize that we need a new perspective in our politics, that we need to find new solutions to how we solve not just the homeless problem, but numerous other issues across the board, and that made me really want to go out of my way to get involved with politics.
Homelessness is one chapter in your life. What else has shaped you and shaped your politics?
Growing up and around the Yurok Reservation. It's an absolutely gorgeous area. It's redwoods as far as you can see and beautiful rivers. But the people there are living a subsistence economy, basically. I can tell you that we're not doing enough to help the native peoples of this land. And we need to do more, and we need to do more effective aid.
But what made him want to speak at age 18 at a giant political rally in Seattle?
Bernie bros. Bernie supporters stereotypically are just white middle-class people who are very privileged. And I wanted to show that there's more to Bernie supporters than just that. And on top of that, I wanted to show, especially to my tribe, but also to Native American communities across the nation, that there are young Natives that are involved and that want to help.
What was that experience like for you? You're up there. This is March 20th. What's your memory of that moment?
I've never taken drugs. The best way I can describe it is being high. Going up for the first 5 to 10 seconds, you're just up there. You're just taking it all in. You're taking it in that there are like 30,000 people watching you at this moment. And so then you just got to rush through it. You got to force yourself to read the lines, to get passionate about your issues, and to really get involved. And so the best way I can describe the entire experience is just as a sort of high, because as soon as I stepped off that stage, I wanted to do it again.
Charles Adkins. He's 18 years old, and he's running to be a delegate for Bernie Sanders at the Democrats' National Convention this July in Philadelphia. So is he going to back Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee? He tells me he hasn't decided. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Later this month, we'll bring you the story of how one voter who's trying to become a Hillary Clinton delegate first got into politics. Thanks for listening to The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. When Charles Somm Nguyen was a kid in Oregon, his mom would occasionally tell stories over dinner. Stories about living in labor camps, of running away as bullets whizzed past her ears, of finding her sister dead.
Growing up, I thought these experiences were pretty terrible, but then I thought everyone had parents that went through rough times. So it didn't occur to me that what she was going through was really horrific, and it was really life-changing.
Charles's mom and family lived in Cambodia in 1975 when Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge took power. During their brutal 4-year rule, the Khmer Rouge killed nearly 2 million Cambodians through execution, starvation, and exhaustion from overwork, including half of Charles's family. But his mom didn't tell him about that. Like many younger generation Cambodian Americans, Charles had to piece that part of his family's history together on his own. Charles told me his own curiosity about Cambodian history and culture began when he visited the country with his mom when he was about 12.
And I got to meet my uncles and my relatives in Cambodia for the first time. We went to her father's village in Cambodia, and I got to go to Angkor Wat in Siem Reap. And I started to ask about what happened here in Cambodia and started talking to my uncles. And then when we came back to the States, I started becoming more curious and asking more and more questions.
What about in school? What did you learn about the Khmer Rouge in school, in history class?
I think the short answer is I didn't learn anything in school about the genocide. Whenever I took a U.S. history or world history class, we would stop at the Vietnam War. It kind of gave me a sense that my history didn't matter. It made me feel like my history didn't matter. It was just ignored. And so I had to seek other avenues to try to learn about my history. And that came from books and documentaries and memoirs that I've read by myself to try to learn about what happened.
How common do you think your experience is, though, among Cambodian Americans your age, that they just don't really know what happened to their parents or grandparents? They don't really know about this part of their history.
Well, I think it's pretty common, especially among the younger generation. I think there's several reasons why this might have happened or this happens. I think one reason is because it's very difficult to talk about. It's a very traumatic experience, and it re-traumatizes them to think about this experience, and they go through a lot of anxiety and pain. I can think of my mom, and she tells me how she always has flashbacks to the genocide. She has panic attacks, and same with my grandma. My uncle would find her when she's sitting alone, just quiet, and then she would sometimes just pass out. I think it was just too painful for them to think about. And once in a while, they would bring out a story, but I've never sat down and told us the entire story because it's just too painful for them. And another reason, I think, is because there's this kind of conflict between the younger generation and older generation. The younger generation tries to assimilate into American society, while the older generation has the traditional values that they expect the younger generation to follow. So there's this kind of conflict between kids and their parents. And sometimes we can't communicate with our elders. For example, my brothers, they can understand Khmer, but they can't speak Khmer. And so they can't ask my grandma these difficult questions and ask what happened. Whereas I know some conversational Khmer, and I can ask some questions once in a while.
Do you want to ask these questions?
I do. Whenever I ask my parents or my grandma, sometimes they tell me, oh, why are you asking me these questions? It's hard to think about. I don't want to think about this. And I just stop. And I just stop asking. But then I get the courage to ask again. And then they tell me a little bit more. And sometimes I just care about them too much that I don't want to hurt them. And I don't want them to think about this horrible experience. And I'm actually still apprehensive about asking my grandma because she lost so many people close to her that I don't want her to live through this experience again. But I know that it's really important for others to learn about this. I was talking to my mom about the experience the other day, and she was asking me, why are you asking me this? Like, why do you want to know? And I said, well, it's important to know so that future generations can learn about this experience and not forget.
I'm talking with Charles Nguyen. He's a representative of the Cambodian Cultural Alliance of Washington. And he's telling me the story of how he learned about his mom and grandmother surviving the brutal regime of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. They ran that country from 1975 to 1979. And during that time, they killed nearly 2 million Cambodians. How do you see the legacy of the Khmer Rouge in the lives of the older generation of Cambodian Americans that you know?
There's a lot of mental illness in the community that is not diagnosed. There's a lot of PTSD that's not diagnosed. And this comes from, there's just a stigma against seeking help for mental health issues. My mom recently sought a counselor and psychiatrist. And she went to see a psychiatrist for 12 weeks and was able to be diagnosed with PTSD. And that wasn't until a year ago. So she's been living with this mental illness for a very long time and just hasn't been diagnosed. I think it's sad that there's a stigma in the community, and I hope that there's a movement to have the older generation to open up and try to heal. And I think that starts with telling stories and sharing what happened to them.
For you personally, why do you want to know these stories?
I feel like there's a part of my past, my family's past, that is missing, and I'm trying to connect the dots and trying to figure out what happened to my family. And I still don't know where all my family are in Cambodia. And I'm just trying to preserve whatever history we have so that I can tell my kids, I can tell my grandkids what happened, and so they would know so that this event will never happen again.
I've asked you how you see the legacy of this genocide in your mom's generation, but what about you? How do you think the legacy of that event touches you?
As I learn more and more stories about my family, I feel more of a motivation to try to preserve our culture. I was really proud of my culture when I went to Cambodia and going to Angkor Wat and seeing the cultural shows and seeing the beautiful temples and costumes and dances that survived the genocide, the Khmer Rouge tried to eliminate the entire culture from society. And I think it's amazing that Cambodians have preserved this culture to this day. And I think that's a testament to the resilience of the Cambodian people.
Charles Som Nguyen is currently a first-year medical student in Oregon. I talked with him last year about his family. The Khmer Rouge took control of Cambodia 41 years ago, and nearly 2 million Cambodians died during their regime. The Wing Luke Museum in Seattle is hosting an exhibition about the Cambodian-American experience. It's open through mid-November. Olympia writer Jim Lynch's new novel takes us to Seattle's working waterfront. It's called Before the Wind, and it's about the Johansons, a family who works on boats and loves them, but they don't always love the boat's owners. Ross Reynolds asked Jim Lynch to read a part of the book where the mother of the Johanson family answers the question, "Why do you feel so good out on the water?"
Mother loved these sorts of questions. Why do we laugh when something is funny? Why do we dream of flying? "Well, it's the same feeling we get when we walk along the ocean, isn't it?" she began, indirectly, as usual. "It's that ionic lift from salty water, sure, but it's more than that, isn't it?" We were all saying yes and nodding and listening hard in case she put her finger on something revelatory. "And it's even more powerful when you're out on the water all day because the rise and fall of the ocean connects you to the sun and the moon, right?" With her eyes squeezed shut, we knew not to rush her. "That alone might make us feel good. But let's not forget we live on a planet that's mostly water, and so are we, right?" We were too tired to respond. "Sure, whatever, yes. And we know all of life began in salty water, so maybe the reason we feel like we're glowing or buzzing at times like these is that when we're out here, every cell in our body is saying, 'Mama!'" After a thoughtful lull, Ruby broke the silence by shouting, "Mama!"
So that's how you describe the sensation of being on the water and why it might be so mystical. How would you describe it personally? How do you feel when you're sailing?
Well, for me, it kind of connects me to my childhood is one of my first reflexes. I think part of it was that when I was a kid, my dad was always in the best mood when we were on water. And so I think that was kind of the first communication to me that this was, you know, something to be revered, and it just kind of stuck with me. I like the challenge of it, and I love the lulls too. I was so happy when I was researching the book to find out that Albert Einstein was a lifelong sailor, loved to sail, and there aren't that many written words about actually, you know, what kind of sailor he was and so on. But I pored over everything there was, and it appeared that he particularly liked to be out in lulls when there was no wind and he could drift around and scribble down his ideas. And the fact that he also just loved it as the ultimate escape, you know, that back then without cell phones, of course, that he could get away from his students and his peers and the media and his family and just think.
Did you write any of Before the Wind or scribble notes for it while you were sailing?
Well, I'm usually someone in charge of the sailing, but I wrote a lot on the boat. And I actually ended up the final draft of this novel I wrote using my boat as an office. I would get up in the morning, I would go down to the marina, and I'd crawl on board. And nobody knew I was there. I didn't have Wi-Fi. And then I had the smell and the atmosphere of a sailboat. And that's actually when it all started to take off for me. There's a certain moment whenever I'm writing a book where I keep waiting for it to finally lift off and for the characters to feel as real as my friends and family. And that's where it happened, was actually on the boat, which all made me feel justified in buying the boat, of course.
Well, there's the beauty and the allure of sailing. And then there's the gritty reality of building and maintaining sailboats. You write that running a boatyard is like running a dementia clinic. How so?
The point I was getting at is just that I watched all these guys that work in boatyards, men and women, And they're constantly having to counsel the boat owners and make them feel all right about the fact that they're spending far more on their boat than they can afford, or that they basically should give up on this boat and go find another boat. But there's all these this kind of delusion that boat owners have about their boats. They get so attached to them that they fail to realize that their boat is ordinary or worse or needs a lot of work. They get a very sentimental relationship to the boat, and it often it's like telling somebody that you need to put their dog down. It's an unusual.
But even the experienced sailors who know better and maybe don't have more money than they have intelligence about it, which some of the novices experience, they have this love affair with their boats.
Right. Well, I grew up the son of a father who had love affairs with boats, and we used to walk the docks down around Shilshil and all, and he. Told me what gorgeous sailboats were, you know, and he had all the drawings at home. He was considering making them and so on. So I had a role model on kind of the sailing obsession in my father.
As a boat owner, what do you think of the old saying, happiest two moments in a boat owner's life are the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat?
Well, I guess I'm more sentimental about my boats. I sold a boat that I'd had for 10 years, and I felt almost weepy leaving it. So there's been boats I've been happy to sell. But I think you can also generate a lot of affection for them. And then when you see them, and so I've sailed past my old boat with my new boat because my old boat's still in Olympia, and I'm so happy that it's in the hands of some guy who takes really good care of it, and he he oils all the wood, and the boat just looks great. But I'm going past him in my bigger, faster dream boat, and so
the old girlfriend.
Yeah, it is the old girlfriend phenomenon. Yeah.
Jim Lynch is with us. He's from Olympia. And his latest novel is called Before the Wind, about sailing, about a sailing family. Your book is set in so many familiar places. The Johansson family's first shipyard is on the Ship Canal here in Seattle. The mother teaches at Ballard High School. The scenes of sailing are on Puget Sound. What was the picture you wanted to reveal about our region's boat culture?
I wanted to try to get across the richness and the fascination that I have with this boating culture. I think it's a big chunk of the way we are here. I mean, with Lake Washington and Puget Sound, we have a geography that's unlike just about anywhere else. And Puget Sound stretching up into the San Juans and into Canada, this whole inland sea is considered one of the great boating wonderlands of the world. And yet, I think those of us that don't actually get out on boats, for them, it's more a part of the scenery. But I think it's actually kind of inherent in our whole culture and style of people that we have out here. You know, we have the mountaineering crowd, you know, we have the downhill skiing crowd, and we have your boating crowd, and they create a certain kind of personality, a certain kind of person, in my opinion. If you spend enough time on the water, you get a certain confidence about your own ability to survive in awkward predicaments because you run into them out there. And you also have just a different vantage on where it is that we live, because when you're just seeing this area from the land, you're kind of missing one of the main angles of it. And one of the things that's always fascinated me is just that you go through the Ship Canal, you go through the locks, and it's almost like you enter the rest of the world because suddenly you're in salt water, and from there you can go anywhere. And I just remember being kind of dazzled by that as a kid, that the whole world opened up.
There's so much anxiety, particularly in Seattle, about the wealth that's coming here, the tech people who are coming here, and the concern that kind of the things that make this place special are going away because of it. Do you think there's any threat to that when it comes to boating culture, when it comes to kind of the hardscrabble families like the Johansson that are basically getting by?
I think there is reason to be concerned about that, and that's also kind of part of why I like setting a big chunk of the novel down in Olympia, because Olympia is maybe economically and so on kind of like Seattle was 30, 40 years ago, in that the houses cost half as much and the boating culture down there is far more affordable. And it's kind of a peaceful old Puget Sound. There's no freighters, there's no ferry boat waves, and yet we've got our own kind of boating mecca down there as well. And I think that it has changed pretty dramatically since when I was a kid, when we used to go up into the San Juan Islands, and now all the boats are considerably larger. You know, the average size of a boat is considerably larger. And you go farther up into Canada, up into Desolation Sound, and then it's just kind of yachts, and then a few hard scrabble boats mixed in. Yeah, it's definitely changing.
And indeed, the Johansson family starts out on the Ship Canal here in Seattle, and there have been some tensions about the working waterfront and and working things along there with a competition from others who'd like to use that waterfront for other reasons. And the Sun ends up at a shipyard down in Olympia. Is there a nod here to kind of the pressures which have been on working class businesses along the ship canal and places like that?
I have kind of a nostalgic love of the older ship canal, and I love the ship canal. I just think it's such a intriguing body of water to pass through. I like it being a working waterfront. I like the fact that you still have the fishing boats down in Ballard and the fishing vessels kind of lodge together as these rusting edifices downtown. I don't want it to see it become a waterfront of luxury yachts.
Olympia writer Jim Lynch talking with Ross Reynolds. Lynch's new novel is Before the Wind. This Saturday, the Seattle Yacht Club hosts its annual opening day boat parade. The parade starts at noon at Portage Bay and ends at 3 at Webster Point. Are you near the end of that book you're reading and you're not sure what to read next? Well, here's a book recommendation from Nancy Pearl with Marcy Silman.
This is a novel by Justin Tussing, who is, I believe, a very young writer, and it's called Vexation Lullaby. And I have to say, that's what drew me to this book.
The title?
The title. I thought the title was great.
When I hear a title like that, I think, this must be something humorous.
No. Vexation Lullaby happens to be the name of a song by by one of the three main characters in this novel. And the singer-songwriter, think of Bob Dylan. And think of actually of Bob Dylan's titles. So Vexation Lullaby fits right into that, the sort of thing that Dylan used to write or still writes.
So is this about musicians?
Yes. This is about a tour with this famous Bob Dylan-like musician. And it's told from the point of view of two people. One of them is a young doctor named Peter Silver, who gets a call in the middle of the night asking him to come to a hotel to take care of this mysterious patient. And he ends up, for various reasons, which you have to read the book to find out, going along on this tour with the folk rock musician.
Many strings of thought are running through my head.
Yes.
You're describing this not long after the musician Prince was found dead.
Right.
And had a lot of medical issues. I'm also thinking of Cameron Crowe's movie Almost Famous.
Yeah. When I was reading this book, I was thinking of Cameron Crowe's movie too, which I just loved. And this is both like it and unlike it, because Jimmy Cross, who is the Bob Dylan type singer-songwriter, has some kind of relationship with Peter Singer, the young doctor, but we don't really know what that is. And as the book progresses, we get various hints. The other main character in this book, and perhaps the more interesting main character, is Jimmy Cross's greatest fan, a middle-aged man named Arthur Pennyman, who has been to every one of Jimmy Cross's concerts over the last 20 years. So he follows Jimmy Cross wherever he goes and has these very detailed lists of the songs that he plays, has played at every concert. So he can really in some ways predict what's going to come next. And his story, I think, was the one that I found the most interesting. Although I loved the sections with Peter Singer, who's really this kind of wussy doctor.
So we both like the film Almost Famous. Who might like reading Vexation Lullaby?
I think the same people who liked Almost Famous. I think this is a really good sort of rock tour novel. And if you like music, and especially if you like the kind of music, because it comes across so well in here, the kind of music that Dylan wrote and played and continues to do so, then I think that this is a book for you.
Vexation Lullaby. And I suppose a tour could be a vexation, but we'd have to read more to find out why he chose that particular title. The author is Justin Tussing, T-U-S-S-I-N-G. Wow, Nancy, thank you so much for bringing this book in.
You're welcome, Marcy.
Nancy Pearl talking to KUOW's Marcy Silman. And you can find more of Nancy's book picks at our website. Go to KUOW.org and search for Nancy Pearl. Thanks for listening to The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. Bill Radke is back tomorrow.